A podcast of the cinema.
Thank you for singing at me.
That was off mic.
Thank you for it anyway.
Okay, you're welcome.
It's nice when you sing to me. I like it.
Most don't, so I'm glad.
Who don't?
Just I would say random strangers who heard me trying to sing would be not down for that. But
when
know.
Do you do that?
I don't. I'm just.
Do you go around singing to random strangers?
No, this is purely theoretical.
Our neighbor Gary Cotty does.
That's true. Yes.
The way I know if he's on his way over is because I hear him down the street, coming down the street. He's got his headphones on. He's singing along to whatever he's got on his headphones.
Right.
Loudly.
Yes.
And people walk past him, they're like, right on, dude.
We should
California lifestyle. Indeed. Do what you want.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. We're film critics. We are married to each other.
I
this can, is our show.
I'll sing to all of you right now if you'd like. Once upon a time, I sang the theme from the Pippi Longstocking movie on this show. I was reminded of that this week by someone on Twitter who said they finally heard that episode and they loved me singing the Pippi Longstocking song.
Well, if you want to show off your vocal prowess, that is kind of a go-to song. So, you know, it's you and your best.
In this house, anyway.
Absolutely. You'll love her, too.
So, she's such an imp. This week was weird.
Yes.
In that, I've seen literally one movie.
Yes. And it's the one that I didn't.
And it's the one that you didn't. And the reason I saw one movie and did not accomplish anything related to my actual job other than this one movie is because I was in bed and on the couch all week being real sick. And so to pull a tiny amount of my own weight this week, I did watch a film that is a current film.
Right.
And we'll get to it later because you have seen things that are in theaters. You were not sick this week. You got to leave the house. You got to go out and see films.
And live life.
So this is kind of an unusual episode in that, you know, often there's, you've seen something, I've seen something, we've both seen something.
Right.
We go back and forth, we come together.
This may be the first time ever that we have no overlap whatsoever.
We may have had no overlap before, but I've never been in a situation where I was just flattened by illness and couldn't even really watch anything except Maury Povich.
Well, I will valiantly attempt to hold up my end and talk about
these
movies. Well,
you're not going to hold up your end. You're going to carry this entire episode.
And then
I'm going to do my best to yes and you.
And we'll start dipping into some letters.
Like a good husband.
Because we're behind on those. So yeah.
Sure.
Real quick, International Podcast Day was this weekend. And
yes.
We made available to folks Linoleum Knife and Fork and LKTV, which are two podcasts that we do that are normally only available to our subscribers at Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
We get your money.
Right. But to celebrate International Podcast Day, we made them available to everybody in the hopes that, you know, the first one's always free. And once you've had a taste, you'll come back for that sweet, sweet TV criticism and food commentary from two film critics.
With all your money.
Yes.
Those are all on iTunes. So if you subscribe to Linoleum Knife, you got them automatically in your...
Correct.
In your queue.
But if not, if you need to go find them, they also are available for free on our Patreon page, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yeah.
All right. So big movie this weekend is American Made. Although apparently, last I heard, it was duking it out still with It and Kingsman for number one, and I think maybe lost to It in the final run.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It is okay.
But that's not what I hear.
Well,
I hear a lot of good things from a lot of people whose opinions I respect.
Well, why don't you go get one of them to be on this show? Because I'm here to tell you it's okay. It's one of those movies where...
First of all, you're going to have to tell me what it's about.
I'm getting there.
And who's in it.
I'm getting there, too.
All right.
Why don't you... What happened to the part where you were going to yes and me?
I would rather just drive over you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Put down the bullhorn and let me do my job. Thank you very much. It's one of those movies that when you squint at it, you can kind of see the movie that it was supposed to be and the movie that it even maybe thinks it is.
All right.
But it's not. Okay. It stars Tom Cruise. It is about a real-life person, although if you read the article on Slate, they fudged a lot of the facts, as these movies based on a true story so often do.
Right.
The beginning of the movie, it's the late 70s, and he is a TWA pilot and kind of bored with the routine, does little things like smuggle Cuban cigars out of, like, Canadian cities and that kind of thing. A mysterious figure from the CIA, we think, played by Donald Gleason, recruits him originally to start ferrying, I'm trying to remember how the sequence of events here, but basically this guy gets involved in running guns to the Contras. He then gets to know the people in the Medellin cartel who want him to start flying their product back into the U.S. And so then this whole complicated thing happens where he's running guns in one direction and drugs in the other one, and he's flying up Contras to be trained in Arkansas to go fight the Sandinistas. But
so this is in the 80s.
Yeah, it starts in the early 70s, but it's getting into the early 80s.
Right.
And obviously once... they lose about half of the Contras once they get to Arkansas because they're like, hey, America! And they just run away rather than stick around to be trained to, like, go shoot people. It is that kind of American satirical look at the Reagan years and how the government was involved in all these really shady illegal things and, you know, Iran-Contra and, you know, Ollie North pops up as a character. And in a way, it's kind of the anti-Top Gun in that Tom Cruise is once again playing this great pilot, but he is, you know, got a plane full of cocaine.
Okay.
And so the political satire feels kind of familiar. They're not ripping the lid off of anything. We know this stuff now and we know it well. And the movie doesn't take an... It's directed by Doug Liman, who did Edge of Tomorrow. He did the first Bourne movie. He did Go, which is a great movie about drugs. There's never a really unhinged sense of satire going on or, like, really sort of dark sense of humor to kind of make this a new take on the story. It's just ultimately about this guy who winds up with, you know, suitcases full of cash and... then finally gets shut down by the government. And, you know, it's breezy enough, but it doesn't... You can sense that this is a movie that feels... That the movie thinks it has some kind of satirical punch about the government or about, you know, the shady dealings of the Reagan era in the closing years of the Cold War. But it doesn't say anything particularly new or different about any of those things. And Tom Cruise is fine. He is operating very much in his wheelhouse. It's a role that calls upon him to be charming and, you know, cocky and,
right.
You know, it's, I kind of feel like there's two kinds of Tom Cruise performances. There's the one that we totally expect going in. And then there's the one that will maybe play around with his image or attempt to glimpse at something darker beneath the facade, like something like Magnolia or Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm-hmm.
This is very firmly in category one.
I see.
So, yeah, it's kind of whatever. But it's,
I like Jack Reacher.
No, oh God. You didn't like the second Jack Reacher.
I didn't see the second
Jack Reacher. Ah, well. There you go.
I like that first one, though.
The first one was fun. Because you like that Jai Courtney.
Oh, I forgot that he was in it.
And that Werner Herzog.
I like that Werner Herzog. Why was I all stoked to see this then, and now I'm less than that?
I don't know. You know, this was one where they opened it in the UK like a month ago or something.
Really?
Yeah. I assigned a review for the wrap with my London stringer, because they just, yeah, it's going to open there first. And that already to me was kind of like, okay.
Interesting.
This was a movie that you maybe for a hot second you thought was going to have some award potential, but now clearly you've decided it doesn't.
Hmm.
Sometimes, something about studio release dates are entrails to be read very frequently.
They often are. Yeah,
oh, what's that? True. You're moving it to Labor Day weekend? Oh, interesting. Oh, it was going to come out in August and now it's opening in February? Oh, interesting.
You also saw Battle for the Sexes. Or sorry,
Of the Sexes.
Battle for the Sexes of the Apes. The apes are fighting over the sexes with the humans. Who will get control of all the sexes?
With tennis rackets. Yeah, Battle of the Sexes is from the husband and wife directors of Little Miss Sunshine. Mm-hmm. And it is about the legendary Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King match of the early 70s.
Yes.
It's funny.
Do you remember that as a child?
I remember it happening. I don't really remember watching much of it, but I sort of remember the cultural phenomenon of it.
Me too. I didn't watch it when it happened. I don't remember from my childhood knowing who won.
I do remember that she won. It was a big deal when she won.
But I do remember that it was the first time that I heard people talking about what was then known as women's lib.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And I was...
Liber versus the lobber.
I was a little kid and in elementary school. And I remember thinking, why are people upset? You know, why are people arguing about this? Mm. Why is this a thing? Because it's just two people playing tennis. It didn't make any sense to me. I think it might have also been the first time I heard about the existence of tennis. But I remember thinking, well, that's a game, a sport that people play. And why are people thinking that she can't win? Like, in my head, it didn't make any sense. Because children have to have these adult prejudices explained to them.
Yeah, you've got to be carefully taught about gender, among other things.
Yeah, and so I just, that was my confusion at the time.
Right.
You can't do that. You're a girl.
Yeah.
But see, meanwhile, on Saturday morning cartoons, I'm watching
Electra Woman and Dyna Girl?
I'm watching Electra Woman and Dyna Girl. I'm watching that cartoon series called Kid Power. I'm watching, remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It was terrible.
Yes. Based on the comic strip Wee Pals, which was also terrible.
I'm watching, you know, at night I'm watching the Free to Be You and Me special, and I don't understand when I'm being told one thing by the media that, you know, boys and girls can do everything, and they do things together, and, you know, it didn't occur to me that that was not supposed to be the case.
Adults needed to be told this as well.
Adults
apparently.
Need, yeah. Anyway, I digress. Tell me about this film.
Okay, yeah. So the movie, it's funny because I just watched, as a counterpoint, the early 2000s TV movie about this very same event called When Billy Beat Bobby, which was directed by Jane Anderson for ABC. And weirdly enough, Jane Anderson is a lesbian, and there is no lesbianism in the TV movie at all.
Interesting.
It's completely covered up. Even though there's some chyron at the beginning, says like, you know, based on conversations with Billie Jean King or blah, 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 or interviews.
All right. So
this movie takes a much deeper dive. We see the whole thing is basically set against Billie Jean King's, and this is touched upon a little in the TV movie. She was a real pioneer in terms of demanding that female tennis players be paid equivalently.
Oh, okay.
So you would have like the U.S. Open or whatever, these big tournaments, the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association, where the men's purse would be like $20,000 and the women's would be, you know, $2,500. Just insane kind of disparities like that. So Billie Jean King and her manager Gladys, who's played by Sarah Silverman brilliantly, decide, all right, screw it. You're not going to pay us the same, even though we are as much of a draw in terms of selling tickets. Then we're not going to play in your tournament. And that's where the Virginia Slims tournament started, because they got them on as a sponsor, and they had this touring thing of, started out with like 8 or 10 women who created their own championship, basically.
Hmm.
So then you've got Bobby Riggs, played by Steve Carell, who is retired, kind of over the hill, but, you know, a good time guy, likes to gamble. So he'll do these things where he'll get society dudes to play tennis against him, where he'll have like 2 Airedales on a leash, or he'll be holding an umbrella, like just the weird things to handicap himself.
Okay.
And he'll still beat the other guy.
Right.
You know, even though, you know, like at one point he wins a Rolls Royce Silver Shadow from somebody, but then has to hide it from his wife, played by Elizabeth Shue, who's this sort of like kind of fancy rich society lady who thinks that he's stopped gambling.
I see.
There's a lot of really great character actor performances in this movie, you know, just kind of dotted throughout. So that's one of the best things about it. So he decides that Bobby Riggs figures that there's publicity to be had in creating this battle of the sexes because of, you know, what Billie Jean King's fight to have women tennis players get paid the same. He's like, no, women belong in the kitchen and the bedroom, and men are better athletes, and women don't deserve the money, and blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
So originally he challenges her, and she's like, no, forget it. I don't have time. I'm doing this Virginia Slims thing. Like, I don't have time for your nonsense. So he instead plays Margaret Court, who is this Australian women's champ, who actually, during the Virginia Slims thing, beats Billie Jean King to become the top seeded woman in tennis. Margaret Court, it should be noted, big right-wing evangelical Christian homophobe.
Oh, really?
And that's touched upon in the film as well, which I'm glad, because she deserves it.
Okay.
In fact, still alive, I think, is currently actively lobbying against marriage equality in Australia as we speak.
Oh, good for her.
Because that's where she's from, yeah. Thanks.
Keep yourself away from me.
So Riggs plays Margaret Court, beats her, and then Billie Jean King's like, now I have to play him.
Right.
While all this is going on, she's married to her husband, who's her manager. You know, he's the only guy she's ever been with. Perfectly happy together. But then she meets a hairdresser played by Andrea Riseborough.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a spark. And suddenly, like, the two of them are hot and heavy and become a thing.
Nice.
And so
it's... Go lesbians.
Yay. So, yeah, so it's about her sexual awakening and about her political awakening. And it's another movie that I would put in the category of, it's nice. It's charming.
Okay.
It's not great. It didn't blow me away. And I think, you know, it might have, given all the elements to it. It's directed, I mean, it's written by the guy who did Slumdog Millionaire.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little, you know, feel goody at times when it could have gone deeper.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It's fun to watch. Emma Stone and Steve Carell are terrific. And like I said, there's a lot of, you know, like Bill Pullman plays the a-hole who runs the USLTA. And, you know, Bobby Riggs's cronies are played by people like Jamie Sheridan and John C. McGinley.
Okay.
So there's a lot of fun character actor stuff throughout. And it's a perfectly entertaining movie. You'll be glad you saw it, but it doesn't, you know, it premiered at Telluride. They're definitely positioning it to be all awardsy, and it doesn't...
Oh, good. So they'll be sending it to us here any minute now.
Indeed, they will.
Right on. I hate having to buy tickets.
Yes, I know you do. I wish it had a little more heft to it, I think. Because it could have, and still have been fun.
That's what people say about this podcast, too.
More heft?
That it should have more heft.
If we personally had any more heft, we'd be crashing through the floor.
No, we don't need any more heft. We got a lot of that.
Yes. What else? What else did I see? I don't even remember.
I've got my list right here.
That's why I'm asking you.
You saw, and I didn't. American Made? Check. Battle for the Sexes of the Apes? Check. Stronger,
yes. Okay.
The Britney Spears story.
If only. It is a true story about a real person. That person is Jeff Bauman, who was a survivor of the Boston Marathon bombing.
Yes.
But who lost both legs. He was at the finish line, actually saw one of the bombers, and his description to the FBI helped them capture this guy. So in addition to the so
I thought Mark Wahlberg did everything.
Right? I know. That's what that movie lied, apparently. Mm. So Bauman, between being a hero for you know, helping nail the bombers and his own sort of personal sacrifice, became kind of the face of the bombing and you know, the face of Boston Strong, you know, that whole thing came up.
Right.
And that's obviously a lot for one person to have to bear.
Yes.
And the movie is basically about, you know, it's about him bouncing back and learning how to use his prosthetic legs and everything, but it's about sort of bearing the burden of so many people's expectations and so many people's feelings about this traumatizing event, you know, and his right. the obviously the PTSD that he goes through, and you know how it affects his relationships with, you know, he has this, the reason he was there was to cheer on his sort of on again off again girlfriend, and you know, she obviously
wasn't running.
Oh no! He was cheering her on. Yeah.
Oh man.
She's a nurse played by Tatiana Maslany. And so obviously she suddenly now feels responsible for his, you know, taking care of him, and he's living with his mom, who's played by Miranda Richardson. I love Miranda Richardson, but her Boston accent.
Oh no.
It's a lot. The movie, it's directed by David Gordon Green, who I think is a fascinating filmmaker, although so wildly hit or miss for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he's made some of the best films of the last 10, 15 years. But at the same time, he also made, you know, The Sitter and the narrative version of Our Brand is Crisis.
That is also a fact.
So it's like, oh man, you never know what you're going to get with this guy. And this one's better than Our Brand is Crisis, but it definitely, for me, felt like, it made me think, dude, maybe don't do true stories for a while. Maybe go back to making more fictionalized films, because that's where some of your strongest stuff is.
Right.
You know, it's a good Gyllenhaal performance. He loves these performances that require a lot out of him physically. Mm-hmm. You know, Southpaw and Nightcrawler and
yes.
such.
Yes.
For the most part, it felt like it was kind of hitting the notes you would expect a movie like this to hit along the way. There are moments that are really powerful and where, you know, he is genuinely kind of grappling with, you know, the after effects of this horrifying event. And those are interesting, but for the most part, it just, you kind of can sort of tell. I mean, obviously, you know where it's going because it's a true story, but it doesn't take you through an interesting path at all, or at least a particularly different one. And there are scenes with his family that, you know, as the yelling Boston people, that felt like...
Every movie set in Boston has the Boston family that is yelling at each other all the time.
And, you know, and the thing about David Gordon Green is, like, I mean, he can be such a naturalist filmmaker and really plunk you down into these places, these specific places, especially in the South where he's from, that feel completely organic and totally lived in, you know, a movie like Joe or, you know, Manglehorn or, you know, obviously George Washington or all the Real Girls.
Right.
The yelling Boston family, like when they're all in the hospital waiting room and they're all yelling, it reminded me of the scene in The Heat where Melissa McCarthy has to make her family leave town and they're all yelling at each other. It was like that. It was like, oh, great, Ronna and Beverly are here, you know.
Right.
So, I didn't love Stronger. People have been digging it. I mean, the reviews have been good. I don't know that it's doing all that well, you know, box office-wise. But I was kind of disappointed. Because it was Green, I thought it would be better than this. And it feels sort of standard issue for the most part.
Hmm.
And you have to believe me because you haven't seen it yet.
You're not filling me with confidence about anything this week.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's some good stuff in the pipeline. I saw some really great films at Venice. I know they're coming. And I've been hearing things out of other festivals recently that sound really interesting. But yeah, this is not a great week.
Well, I was about to say earlier in this show, I said that I had only seen one film. But in fact, I've seen two, and you and I watched one of them together last night on Netflix.
Oh, that's true. You have. That's right.
There's a new film on Netflix. It's called Our Souls at Night.
Right.
It stars Robert Redford and Jane Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
They are two old people living in a small town in Colorado. And within the first 5 minutes of the film, they are neighbors and have been neighbors for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But don't really know each other all that well.
Yeah. You get the impression that his late wife was friends with her, maybe.
Yes.
But, yeah, the two of them have never really spoken much at all.
And she comes to him and says, I want you to sleep with me. And he gives her the one of the two faces that Robert Redford is capable of giving these days. Come on, you know I'm right.
That's not entirely fair, no, but it's not entirely untrue.
That is true. Listen, I'm going to say something blunt here. Jane Fonda can act circles around Robert Redford.
Well, she always could.
And at this stage in his career, he makes two faces, a half smile and staring. That's kind of what he does.
But he has such presence.
He has a presence. He has the presence of Robert Redford, screen icon.
Yes.
Anyway. She reassures him immediately that she is not talking about having sex with him. She simply wants to lie down in a bed with another human being and talk until they both fall asleep.
Yeah.
So they begin doing that. And over time, they begin...
The relationship deepens.
And they touch each other. Along the way, they have, you know, town gossips to deal with, and they have their own children to tend to. Robert Redford's daughter is played by Judy Greer. She has a nice sequence with them where she hangs out with them. Jane Fonda's son, played by Matthias
Skinnerts, is what I've been told.
Okay. Great Belgian actor who you would not know is from Belgium in this film.
Yeah. I mean, most of the stuff that you've seen him in, you wouldn't necessarily know that he's from Europia.
Yeah.
You know, unless you go all the way back to Bullhead or Rust and Bone. Like, he's done a lot of American films now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you find out these people who seem kind of basic folks on the outside, obviously they've lived a long time and they have regrets from their past. He left his wife for a while for another woman before coming home. She lost a child, and that impacted the way that she raised the other one.
Yes.
And they have to deal with that stuff now that they are both opening themselves up to a relationship again after having, you know, been widowed. And, you know, it takes their lives seriously. It takes their sex lives seriously. And there aren't enough movies about people that age, and that puts them front and center, I think.
I'm gonna kind of place this in the same category as the three that you just told me about. It's nice.
It is nice. Yeah, no, I don't want to oversell this. In my review out of Venice for the Wrap, I was like, this is a nice movie about nice people.
Yeah. It looks like and feels like, in terms of its production values and the way it's shot, its score, pretty much everything except the two leads. This is an expensive Hallmark Channel film.
I think that's pushing it.
I don't think it's pushing
Here's
it at
the thing.
All.
What I think is interesting about the look of the film, and you've called this out in actual Hallmark movies,
mm-hmm.
where you talk about how, like, they just went to Ross Dress for Less and got everything.
Yep.
The fashion and interior decor level here is, I think, believable for these characters.
Absolutely.
And as such, kind of on the dowdy side.
Yes.
You know, when she dresses up for their lunch out, she puts on, like, a denim skirt with kind of a tomato, not even tomato red, like a almost
a lady blouse and a lady blouse jacket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, you know, I think that a Hallmark movie would unthinkingly dress its characters and dress its sets that way. I think this movie is doing it very intentionally because they're not trying to sort of Hollywood up what these two people living in the middle of Colorado in a small town would be like.
I'll agree with you on that. And yet, there's still something a little stiff about everything going on in the film. The score is overbearing.
The score is not great.
And I didn't dislike it.
Oh, and young Sheldon's in it, too.
And young Sheldon plays the grandchild.
Yeah.
Very well. The kid's a good, that kid's a good actor.
He is.
Yeah. I hope that TV show doesn't ruin him.
Mm.
But so, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, it's
fine.
It is fine, and it is on Netflix, so you don't have to make any exceptional effort to see it. It's just there.
Yeah. And here's the one I saw that you didn't.
Yes, also on Netflix.
Also on Netflix, and significantly enough on Netflix, and I'll explain why. Nocturama. It's a French film. It is from Bertrand Bonello, and it's from 2016. No, shot in 2015, but
Bonello's biggest film in the U.S. to date probably was Saint Laurent.
Yeah,
which was the unauthorized Yves Saint Laurent movie that year that we got two of them.
Yeah. This film came out in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Only now is it reaching the United States and only on Netflix. It did not get a theatrical distribution deal in the United States. And reasons. The subject matter is pretty tough and was pretty tough for Europe in 2016
Do we know how Netflix got this? Because they're not usually in the business of picking up, you know, undistributed foreign films.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know that it got some festival dates in the States and played in Los Angeles two nights at the Downtown Independent not long ago.
Okay.
But again, did not get a real theatrical distribution life in the U.S. This film was written several years ago by Bonello and shot and completed before the terrorist attacks that took place in November of 2015 when they shot up the Eagles of Death Metal concert. You remember that?
Right.
You and I were in Napa at the Napa Film
exactly,
Festival.
Exactly, no. And
that weekend.
The depressing thing is I'm trying to get my French terror attack straight, because that wasn't the Charlie Hebdo one, and that wasn't the truck going through the crowd
Correct.
One.
It was the big one in 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah. In November of 2015. This film premiered at film festivals in the beginning of 2016.
Woo.
And here's what it's about. A group of young people in their late teens and early 20s, and a couple of them in their young teens. You know, there's a kid in this movie who looks no older than 13.
Hmm.
They are all races. They are from every strata of socioeconomic class. They are from various religions. They are essentially a Benetton ad of what you would like the utopian version of the New France to look like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, male, female. One of them you sort of come to realize during the course of the film might be gay, mm-hmm. is gay probably. And again, you know, there are all different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
They spend the first 45 minutes of the film plotting a terrorist attack in Paris for no stated reason. Never do they state a reason during the entire running time of the movie as to why they have done what they've done. But they coordinate their attack very precisely and probably perhaps implausibly when you consider their age and their experience and who they are, you know. But they managed to set off a variety of very destructive bombs in the city. And there is never a mention of who has died, if anyone, because of those bombs. Although they do say, one of the kids says, Well, I hope no one died, but, you know, I don't want to know. And then they do an unusual thing. And you would think they would scatter, right? And go into their own separate sort of hiding places. Instead, part of their plot involves, the second half of their plot involves, again, for no stated reason, we don't know why they're doing this, when it is only going to increase their chances of being caught. They go to a very large, very luxurious French department store. Obviously, it's French. It's taking place in Paris. I'm an idiot. And they hide out there overnight. And they've got a friend on the inside who works as a security guard who helps them by murdering the other security guards.
Dude.
And then the next half of the film is them all kind of just going wild in this department store all night.
So it's like Evening Primrose meets
it's like
the Bader Meinhof.
It's like the Breakfast Club with career opportunities and Day of the Jackal and
from the mixed-up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler
and Dawn of the Dead and Elephant, just because of the way it's shot and the sort of detached, distant manner in which all of these kids are treated by the filmmaker.
Do you know Evening Primrose, by the way? That's that Sondheim musical where Anthony Perkins goes to live in the department
store.
That's
right. You showed me parts of that once, and I was blanking on what you, were talking about. And I had become interested in this film because I had heard in some promotional paragraph for it somewhere, I had read they were sort of comparing it to Bresson's The Devil Probably.
Right.
Which
why don't you explain that?
Well, The Devil Probably is a film about a group of disaffected young French teenagers, one of whom is so disaffected that he is going to kill himself, and he talks about it a lot. And he's doing this because the world is a disaster and there's no hope. There's no hope that we can right the course of history to make the world a better place. This film is from the 1970s. He goes so far as to hire another person to murder him.
In The Devil Probably.
In The Devil Probably, yeah. And then that happens. He dies. The gun goes off. He dies at the end. And it's a pessimistic film. And I now understand, having seen Nocturama, those parallels. There are certainly some stylistic parallels, not with the way Bresson shot people, but with the way...
Filmed people.
Correct.
But just to be clear.
But with, you know, the camera's, you know, insistence on showing, you know, hands... Hmm. Which is a big Bresson trademark. You know, you see parts of bodies, you don't see bodies. But in as much as it borrows anything from The Devil Probably, it also borrows, like I said, it borrows from Career Opportunities, a John Hughes film about kids who lock themselves in a Target overnight. And that's a comedy. There are elements of comedy in this film because they retreat in a way after they've committed this most heinous diabolical act. They retreat to being kids again. They learn about what they've done while watching. This is the most glorious scene in the film. They learn about the visual scope of what they've done from watching many TVs in the electronics department of everything happening at once, while one of the other kids is screwing around with the audio equipment and Willow Smith's I Whip My Hair Back and Forth is playing, booming across the soundtrack, and it's mesmerizing.
Wow.
So the retreat into the mediated sort of reality that kids often experience through the internet, through television, through music video, that is how they are learning about their own destructive evil.
Interesting.
And the film itself, I think, I do not believe that it glorifies terrorism at all. And I do not believe that it is anything worse than a a bad timing situation in terms of how it is
sure.
to be seen in the world.
Well, it's like, speaking of Sondheim, Assassins kept
coming
to Broadway at the worst possible times.
Yes. So I think this is a stunning sort of bit of, you know, a stunning example of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's daring and visually extravagant and gorgeous to look at. Occasionally a little up its own butt, but, you know, lots of great things are.
In a French way.
Yeah. I highly recommend it.
Okay.
It is a bummer. No lie about that at all. It's a bummer. But the synthesis of its themes, what it borrows from, the sort of performances from the kids who are all definitely very deadpan about everything, except for the one kid that you find out is probably gay.
Hmm.
And I won't tell you what he does, because that's another amazing musical sequence.
Huh.
Yeah. Such a strange movie and so overwhelmingly provocative and pushy and at the same time, you know, stylish and bitter.
Yeah, all right.
It's one of the best things I've seen all year.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's currently streaming on Netflix, at least in the U.S., and Our Souls at Night is streaming on Netflix everywhere. It is an international title for them. So.
Yeah, I have no idea what this movie's doing on Netflix. Who asked for it? And, I mean, maybe it was part of some package.
I'm sure it was part of a deal of something else, and they just got that one too. But good to know. We have some letters.
We do. Did you stop the recording while I looked up the? No, you just. I just started singing.
That's my hold music.
Okay. Well, now I'm ready.
I do Tijuana Taxi.
This could have gone on for moments and moments, and you would have kept on doing Tijuana Taxi.
Well, I don't know why you aren't paying attention. Go right ahead.
This is from Dan. He says, last year I jokingly sent you a letter in which I addressed you as Cuck Boss 1 and Cuck Boss 2. At my request.
Yes. You started all this.
I decided that I wanted to be known as Cuck Boss. If some, you know,
you're the cake cuck.
Dick on the internet was going to refer to me that way anyway, because I'm all, you know, socialist and whatnot. Then might as well be the boss of the cucks.
Own it.
Yeah. And dear God, the alt-right is in power and everything is awful and there are Nazis marching and the world is spinning apart. And sorry, I have these bouts of despair and panic and disbelief with some frequency. Anyway, I noticed that there are some books about film criticism that have come out recently. A.O. Scott's Better Living Through Criticism and Anne Hornaday's Talking Pictures. I was curious if either of you had read either of these new books and had thoughts. Love the podcast. Keep being you. Fight the power. Dan.
Thanks, Dan. I have a copy of Better Living Through Criticism on a stack, and it just feels like such homework that I haven't started it yet. I hear it's good. I've heard people say really interesting things about it, and I mean that as no offense to Mr. Scott, but since this is what I do for a living, you know, I, like many people, find that when I have free time to devote to other media, I like a little escape from what I'm usually dealing with. So I haven't read it yet, but I plan to. And I did not know about Anne Hornaday's book, but she's terrific, so I'm sure it's interesting as well. What are you looking at?
Just trying to get the title of that Jonathan Rosenbaum book that we got a while back. I have not read either one of the A.O.s. I have not read the A.O. Scott book. Or the Anne Hornaday book. But there's a book by Jonathan Rosenbaum that I got a while back called Goodbye Cinema, Hello Cinephilia.
Yes.
It's a book of his, a collection of his writings that I really like.
Hmm.
So
I just have to check it out.
There's one. This one's from Carlos. Hey guys, long time listener, first time writer. I've been avoiding writing you.
Well.
Because I feel the pressure to be as funny and witty as some of your other letter writers, but since I cannot do that, I will just say, number one, Dave is always right.
That's true. I am. Don't encourage him.
And number two, Alonso has magnificent hair.
That is true.
That is true. Your hair is magnificent. My hair is getting to the point of non-existence, but yours is magnificent.
Thank you.
You have a full head of wavy, gorgeous salt and pepper hair.
It's true.
I have an ever-growing orb of baldness on top of the back of my head, and it just keeps going and going and going, and I'm going to look like Dr. Phil before it's all over.
Thank you, Spain. That's all I can say.
Okay. About a year ago, a group of friends and I started getting together to watch movies. We call it DMC, Difficult Movie Club.
No.
I approve of this.
Difficult listening hour.
Anyways, this all started when the BBC listed Mulholland Drive as the best movie of the 21st century. Yes, I know that was a controversial list, as it was. Well, one friend hates that film and ranted on the Book of Face about it, and it started a bit of discussion with us as people took both sides of the debate. In an effort to bring peace to civilization, we decided to get together and watch it and discuss. Lo and behold, while some naysayers may not have had their minds changed, it did lead to a really good conversation. We all had such a good time, we decided to keep it going. Every month, someone gets to choose a film that is difficult, a term we are using loosely. And then we just chat about it. It's just like Oprah's book club. And what's not to love about a group of hairy-bearded gay men eating, drinking, smoking pot, we're in Seattle, and watching a movie? So, y'all bunch of bears.
Yeah.
Okay. If you don't mind, I'd like to see what you all think about our choices of films so far. Oh, this is what they've chosen.
Okay.
Okay. Are we going to knife this list? Let's do it.
Sure.
Keep in mind, each person is allowed to choose whatever they like, and so maybe all of them don't fall into what I would call difficult, but to each their own. Mulholland Drive?
Yes.
We consider that to be good.
Sure.
Embrace of the Serpent.
Haven't seen it yet.
It's a thumb up.
They can't see you, Dave. You have to...
I just gave it a thumb up.
Yes.
Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives.
Well, yes.
That's one of my all-time jams. Repulsion.
Yeah.
The Wailing, which is fantastic.
Which I still need to see. You love that one.
The Lives of Others.
Oh.
Which is fine, but yeah. I wouldn't call it difficult under any circumstances.
Good, yeah.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, same. It's great, but it's not difficult. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Great and barely difficult.
I'll tell you who it was difficult for. My student teacher, Miss Smith. Back when I was in college and I was fixing to become a middle school teacher in Texas, my cooperating teacher in my final year, the woman with whom I did my student teaching,
mm-hmm.
her name was Miss Smith.
In Lubbock.
First name Wanda. Mm. She was terrific. She was so great. She would talk to me all the time, just about the world and life and everything. And one day in the teacher's lounge, the first Gulf War had just started. And she looked at me while I was eating my sandwich, and she said, "Don't feel like you need to tell people your opinion about this in school."
Oh, my.
She goes, "You're a student teacher. Remember that."
Oof.
She said, "I understand what you want to say." She goes, "And this semester, I have learned enough about you to know probably what you would say. I'm telling you, right here, right now, is probably the time for you to be quiet." And I thought, okay.
Heard and understood.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, it she really had my back. And she knew there would be in the future for me a time and place to not be quiet. And she was right.
Indeed. Look at you now.
But she also knew that for the sake of my getting my teacher credentials, I might want to not become a firebrand
mm-hmm.
during student evaluations and stuff like that.
Right.
Anyway, we talked about movies a lot. And I would tell her about the weird movies that I had been watching or going to see. And for God knows what reason, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover came to Lubbock, Texas.
Well, that was an art film that people who didn't go to art films got talked into seeing because of the controversy.
Yep. And she went.
Oh, my.
And the Monday morning after she went, she came to the teacher's lounge and she goes, I saw that movie. I said, uh-huh. She goes, you're a pervert.
That's like when I worked in Nashville and the semester after college, I was working at the Nashville Banner, and I recommended Love is a Dog from Hell.
Oh, good.
To a female coworker.
Yes, of course.
And she was like, eh.
Love is a Dog from Hell, also known as Crazy Love in some countries.
Yes, yeah. Based on the Charles Bukowski
stories. Clown.
I
haven't seen. Deep Red by Dario Argento. Also great. I wouldn't call it difficult, but whatever. The Handmaiden.
Ooh.
Would we call The Handmaiden difficult? We're not judging you on how difficult we think these films are.
Degree of difficulty.
We're just trying to tell your group to, you know, step it up a bit.
I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward, depending on, like, how little exposure you've had to movies that test you narratively.
Yeah. Now, the second thing I'm asking is which... So you get 100% knife, first of all,
sure,
dude.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I'd say about a 50% difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the thing I'm asking is which films would you all suggest we watch?
Oh.
He continues, I've had things like Neon Bull,
mm-hmm.
Ohasard Baltasar, El Topo, and others on my list, but I'd love to hear what you all would suggest. I did have American Ultra on the list, but then I finally saw it and thought, meh.
Ha! So Dave is not always right.
We're not friends now, Carlos. I hope you understand this.
So there. Good question. Well, I mean, the first one I immediately think of is unfortunately not easily available on DVD in this country unless you have a region-free player, and that would be Jacques Rivette's Celine and Julie Go Boating.
Oh! If you can get it, if you can find it, if you can somehow get yourself a hands on a copy of that.
And now if you want some capital D difficult...
Yes.
Jacques Rivette's Out One is on Netflix, all 14 hours or whatever.
Y'all aren't going to do the 14-hour movie.
They could break it up into segments.
You could break it up into
segments. What would you recommend?
Well, you've got Ohasard Baltasar on there. You might go for some Tarkovsky films. Stalker.
Solaris.
Stalker is magnificent.
Ooh, Richard Kelly's The Box.
Would you call that difficult, though? Would you say that's difficult?
I'm talking about
difficult.
It takes
here.
Some turns where you're like,
All right.
Pretty much almost any of the F CinemaScore movies. Like, y'all could go do a field trip and go see Mother.
Right. But I don't think Mother's difficult either.
Well, compared to some of the stuff on that list?
All right. Sure.
Yes.
Sure. Stalker. Tarkovsky's Stalker. Yeah.
Godard's King Lear, also not on DVD, unfortunately. Dang it.
Oh, Film Socialism or Goodbye to Language, if you want later Godard that will challenge you.
Well, do Goodbye to Language, but only if you have a 3D television. Don't do Film Socialism.
This is from Tim. Hello, boys. I've been listening for quite some time, almost from the beginning.
Hmm.
And I'm astounded at the number of hours you log in front of a screen. You go to movies for your job, then you watch movies on TV for work, then you watch other movies on TV to relax. You used to watch regular TV to relax, but now you've made that part of your job. So now you're watching TV for work while watching TV to relax. It's almost frightening to conceive what space-time continuum you're violating when you watch made-for-TV movies. How do you do it? I work at a zoo, and when I go home, the last thing I want to do is have to be the kind to all animals... Wait. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me start that sentence again.
Do that.
I work at a zoo, and when I go home, the last thing I want to do is have to be kind to all animals. And every little bird, damn it. So you are to be commended for your, I don't know what, but I'm sure Alonzo has the proper word for it. Whatever it is, keep it up. And congratulations for doing so. Tim, from Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I made my avocation my vocation, so it just all sort of blurs. I mean, luckily, I guess I mostly like what I do, so, you know, I just spend a whole lot of time looking at stuff. But I'd be looking at it anyway if it wasn't my job, so I still need to develop some kind of pastime that is completely non-related to, you know, my job. If I didn't have carpal tunnel, I'd learn to knit.
Steve, Dr. Scott.
Ah, yes.
After your review of Whose Streets, it was great to hear your interest in attending a Black Lives Matter rally. And knowing that you took notes on Regina Hall's friendly advice to Kate Walsh in the movie Girls Trip, I know that you will be welcomed guests.
We will come correct.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, that's it.
Oh.
We have accomplished letters for the week.
Okay, fine. All right. Well, listen, everybody, if you have not already, go check out Linoleum Knife and Fork and LKTV, which we made available this week for free for International Podcast Day. And if you like what you hear, go to patreon.com/linoleumknife and become a member of our club. Also, we are selling t-shirts, our black t-shirts with Linoleum Knife in white letters across the chest.
And we have
almost all the sizes.
We have kid sizes. We have women's sizes. We have men's sizes. Except we are now completely out of 2X in men's. Because a lot of y'all are shaped just like us.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you want any other size, you can PayPal us $22 at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And if you live outside of the U.S., email us first and find out how much extra you'll need to pay us for postage. Also, because it is the beginning of October, we will soon be offering our annual spate of autographed copies of my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
Not yet.
Not yet.
I'm not ready.
We'll let you know when, but we'll have those available.
Everybody get off of me.
In plenty of time to be Christmas gifts.
Also, I've wasted an entire week being sick.
You didn't waste it. You were sick.
Being sick is for the week. And I have squandered days. I'm now so far behind. My at-a-glance is completely full of tasks that have not been accomplished,
okay.
And life is a chaos.
Just relax. You still got to rest. You got to tend to yourself.
Whatever.
Check out other things on the internet, including my other podcast, Who Shot Ya, on Maximum Fun. Go subscribe to that if you have not, please. Or you can listen to it at MaximumFun.org. Check out ChristyLemire.com and Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney. And the Schmoes Know, congratulations to Christian for your new baby. And Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Comics Canon, Film Spotting SVU, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, The Sewers of Paris, and Secretly Timid. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at LinoleumCast, and you can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. Please leave us a nice review there. It helps so much in helping us stand out amidst the gajillion movie podcasts there are. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher and Google Play and Podbean and whatnot. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. There was another thing that I was going to say that I always say in this part, and I can't remember what it is now.
No, it doesn't matter.
I'm sure it's super important.
It's
nonetheless.
Not.
Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week, and until then,
goodbye.